Good evening, this is Rob McClure and Vicki Iden bringing you your local news live from the newly refurbished middle studio at WORT on Bedford Street in downtown Madison. Here are the headlines for this evening.
The Wisconsin Supreme Court denied a request today to declare which district maps should be the ones used for any potential recall vote for State Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. On first review, the Wisconsin Elections Commission had determined that there were not enough signatures to force a recall vote, but had also sent the matter to the state Supreme Court. They had asked the court to clarify which set of maps would be used in any elections prior to November, when new maps signed into law in February will go into effect. The Elections Commission has until April 11th to decide if the recall effort has enough signatures to force a recall vote.
The State Department of Health Services is announcing how they'll spend $36 million in opioid settlement money that's coming this summer, according to Wisconsin State Journal. The plan includes funding the state's 11 federally recognized tribal nations to go toward opioid prevention, education, and family and peer support resource centers. $3.5 million will go towards increasing the availability of naloxone, or Narcan, which reverses the effects of an overdose if provided quickly. Other funds would pay for fentanyl test strips. Fatalities from fentanyl have outpaced those from prescription opioids in recent years. In 2022, Wisconsin had nearly 1,500 opioid deaths, which was a record number for the state.
Nearly 55,000 people were without power across the state this morning after a winter storm hit. That winter storm brought heavy winds, along with wet and heavy snow in some parts of the state. There were nearly 1,200 outages across Wisconsin, largely in central and northern Wisconsin. The largest number of homes without power was in Menominee, impacting nearly 4,000 people, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. As of this evening, 422 outages remained, impacting over 39,000 We Energy customers across the state and the UP.
And many more details on that topic coming up in the second half. Dane County Executive Joe Parisi announced that he'll retire exactly a month from today on Friday, May 3rd. His resignation comes early and leaves about a year left on his elected term of office. An interim executive is expected to be appointed by the county board to fill out the term until a new executive is elected. Meanwhile, at least four candidates have already announced their run for Dane County Executive, which will be on the ballot this November. This coming April 15th is the first day that candidates can begin to circulate nomination papers for that election. Joe Parisi has spent more than two decades in public office. He's worked as Dane County Clerk, State Assembly Representative, and has been the Dane County Executive since 2011. And those were this evening's headlines, and now on to the rest of the day's top stories.
Under state law, polls open at 7 a.m. and close at 8 p.m. on Election Day. But sometimes extraordinary circumstances can prevent people from voting. That's when election officials can intervene and petition to extend voting hours. And that's why a polling place on the UW-Madison campus stayed open for another hour and a half yesterday. WORT news producer Faye Parks found out the backstory.
In the end, only eight people voted from 8 to 9:30 p.m. at the Memorial Union polling place in the hour and a half emergency extension of voting hours granted by a Dane County judge yesterday. But the process to extend voting hours took the bulk of an afternoon for city officials after they realized some voters had inadvertently been turned away. Alder MGR Govindarajan represents parts of the UW-Madison campus on the Madison Common Council. He says he arrived at the Memorial Union around 3:45 yesterday, planning to join his friend, who was working as a poll observer. He says when he arrived, it was clear something was amiss.
So I went in trying to find the poll station, and all of the signs on the first floor were either gone or facing the wall, so I wasn't really sure which way the arrows were facing. So I went to the front desk to ask where the polling station was, and they told me that the building manager had actually informed that there is no voting taking place within Memorial Union. I found that to be very concerning.
According to Alder Govindarajan, he only knew to keep looking for the polling station because of his role as an elected official. When he and his colleagues on the Common Council approved Madison's polling places, he made sure that Memorial Union was on the list. When he eventually found the polling station, Govindarajan says he informed the site's chief election inspector about the confusion.
And they were mortified. They immediately contacted the building manager, and by 4:15 at the latest, all of the signs were back. They were facing the right way, and Memorial Union staff were given new instructions on where to direct voters asking questions.
Govindarajan says after chatting with staffers at Memorial Union, his best guess is that some potential voters had been turned away for an hour and a half.
I want to emphasize that was probably just a miscommunication. I completely understand that there is no malicious intent over there on their part, but it was a problem nonetheless.
That sparked a scramble from Madison clerk Mary Beth Witzelbale and city attorney Mike Haas to file an emergency petition to extend voting hours for the two affected wards. That request was granted by Dane County Judge Ryan Neilsestoon yesterday evening, as the end of normal voting hours crept up, but not without an emergency hearing. Attorney Haas says he made it a point to alert the Republican and Democratic parties of Wisconsin about the petition, even though that's not required by state law.
I have always taken the approach that if it is a partisan election, that we should try to reach out to the two major political parties or the two campaigns at the top of the ticket and let them know that this is what is happening, and give them an opportunity to make their case if they object. In some cases, in many cases, everybody agrees. This is actually, I think, the first one I've been involved in. There's been a disagreement or an objection.
The Republican Party did object and was represented by attorney Kurt Gore, who has argued for the Republican Party on other election administration cases, including a case over banning ballot spoiling. Alder Govindarajan says,
the Republicans questioned whether there were actually any voters turned away, because there is no evidence of any of this. It's just my testimony.
City Attorney Haas says requests for extended hours happen more often than you'd think. But yesterday's situation was unique for its circumstances and its length.
This is the longest period of time I'm aware of since I started in elections in 2008. The other unique thing is I've never seen it done where the polling place had not had to shut down. You know, in this case, there was still voting going on. It's just that some people were turned away.
Most often, extensions happen when polling places are fully shut down due to things like a bomb scare or alarm. Even severe weather or a car accident that shuts down traffic can prompt an extension. Haas, who worked at the Wisconsin Elections Commission before becoming the city attorney, says more unique circumstances have also prompted voting hour extensions.
I will just tell you the best story, Wisconsin story I've heard of a polling place not being open occurred years ago in northern Wisconsin, where they could not unlock the door to the polling place because the night before the key had been placed under a rock and the rock had frozen to the ground.
Madison clerk Witzelbale says yesterday's grant of an extension from Judge Neilsestoon came with conditions, just in case there's a legal challenge in the future.
Part of the court order was to mark those ballots cast after 8 p.m. and the poll book with the relevant statute, and so that was done by the poll workers.
Haas says the city is following up with UW-Madison to ensure better communication for future elections. Reporting for WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
So just how did yesterday's spring election shake out? There's a lot to keep track of, from county board races to constitutional amendments. Our news producer, Faye Parks, and talk producer, J.D. Siri Ramos, have this breakdown of the results.
I'm Faye Parks, the local news producer, here with J.D. Siri Ramos, who produces WORT's hour-long talk show, A Public Affair.
Hey, Faye, are you ready to talk about yesterday's elections?
Yeah. Voter turnout for Dane County, a bit less than 35%. Last spring's election saw nearly twice as many voters show up to the polls. My guess is that the race for state Supreme Court drew people in.
Yeah, lots of spending in that race. And also, it didn't snow last spring election day.
So true. Let's get into yesterday's spring election results. So starting here in Dane County, there were 10 competitive races for the county board. Eight of those races had incumbents running to retain their seats. The general theme, all the incumbents facing a challenger held on to their seats. Many of those challengers got financial backing from the Republican Party, but couldn't clinch the win.
Okay, wow. Were there any notable county supervisor races that you were paying attention to?
One of the closer races was District 20, with incumbent supervisor and only conservative on the county board, Jeff Wiegand. He faced off against challenger Andrea Andrews, but Wiegand held on to his seat with just over 52% of the vote. He won almost 150 votes more than Andrews and will continue to represent the county's rural northeastern corner.
150 votes is close, but there was a closer race for the seat that represents Cottage Grove. In District 36, David Peterson beat out Laureen Gage by just 6 votes.
Yeah, Peterson got 1,428 votes, while Gage received 1,422. Interestingly, there were 68 write-in votes for that race, too.
Yeah, that close of a margin is enough to trigger a recount. Gage tells the Cap Times that it's probable that there will be one.
One final county board race that's noteworthy, incumbent supervisor and county board chair, Patrick Miles, held on to his seat, representing McFarland. He won about 55% of the vote in a contentious race that's been in the news a lot with challenger Ed Ray.
All right, let's move on to the other races.
Right, so Milwaukee voters approved more than $250 million of additional funding for their school district, but it was a fairly narrow margin, about 51 to 49%.
Oh yeah, that is a thin margin. What does it mean for Milwaukee taxpayers?
Well, if you're one of the rare few that owns a home worth $200,000 in Milwaukee, your taxes will go up by about $430 a year.
Other school districts did not get the same support. The school referendums in McFarland and River Valley failed to get voter approval.
And holy balls, in Wausau, voters rejected their incumbent mayor, Katie Rosenberg, a Democrat, in favor of her challenger, Doug Denny. Denny won just over 52% of the vote. And according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Rosenberg's loss doesn't bode well for the Democratic Party in Wisconsin. Rosenberg is a frequent speaker at Dem events, some held by Governor Tony Evers. But it looks like folks weren't happy with her spending, and she was ousted.
And in my neck of the woods in Monona, there were no registered candidates for the open municipal judge seat. You might remember a Wisconsin State Journal headline that read, "Anyone in Monona could be a judge with write-in vote."
Oh, yeah, I do remember that. We almost launched a campaign for you, I think.
We did. Well, city officials did set a minimum qualification for that seat. Write-in candidates could only win if they were a licensed attorney. Alyssa Mahaffey clinched the win with almost 900 votes. The two other write-in candidates received less than 100 votes total.
The biggest news from last night are the statewide elections, which had 2 referendums and then the presidential primary across the board.
Let's start with the referendums. These were constitutional amendments approved by the Republican legislature that were largely inspired by conspiracies surrounding the 2020 presidential election.
Both questions were worded oddly, but they essentially asked voters to prohibit private funding of elections. That's the Zuckerbucks claim from 2020. Another asked to limit election conduct to election officials only, which is basically how things are already run. And voters said yes. The first got 54% approval, and the second got 59% approval.
Yeah, but in Dane County, we went against the state. We rejected both referendums by nearly 70% each.
And finally, the presidential primary. Statewide, over 48,000 voters voted uninstructed on the Democratic Party ballot. That's just over 8% of the Democratic Party's vote total. For comparison, Joe Biden got more than 500,000 votes.
And remind me, what is uninstructed?
So it's part of a campaign to send a message to President Biden over, largely, his handling of the war in Gaza. Organizers for Uninstructed in Wisconsin say last night's share was more than double their goal. And in Dane County, Democratic voters cast 82,600 votes to Biden and 14,400 votes to Uninstructed.
Meanwhile, on campus, the Daily Cardinal reports that wards representing the campus had Uninstructed votes at nearly 4 times the statewide rate. When asked about the uninstructed vote, the chair of the Wisconsin Democratic Party, Ben Wickler, told the media that the Biden campaign is listening and the party is working to get their support. He added that he thought many uninstructed voters would still vote for Biden come November.
Meanwhile, Democratic candidate Dean Phillips, who fought hard this spring to get his name placed on the ballot in the first place, got about 17,000 votes statewide. He got 1,826 in Dane County.
Meanwhile, in the Republican primary, Nikki Haley won almost a quarter of the Republican votes here in Dane County, but most of the Republican votes were cast elsewhere in the state. Haley won more than 76,000 votes total, though she is no longer in the running. Ron DeSantis got just over 20,000 votes. Chris Christie got slightly less than 10,000 votes, and the uninstructed opinion got almost 13,000 Republican votes.
Despite clear voter dissatisfaction with both frontrunners, President Joe Biden and Donald Trump are the de facto nominees. And that does it for our wrap-up. I'm Faye Parks.
And I'm Jade Siri Ramos.
There has been a lot of debate about Dreamers, minors who immigrate to the U.S. alongside their undocumented guardians. But what about parents who do obtain work visas and bring their minor children with them? When those young people turn 21, they face deportation. WORT reporter David Ahrens attended a press conference today about the issue.
At the press conference today, the group of young people who happen to have immigrated to the U.S. as children face a unique problem. Despite the fact that they have lived here legally most of their lives, they will be deported at the age of 21. These young people face deportation to a country where they never lived and may speak little of the native language. They're called Documented Dreamers. They met up with area legislators, Representatives Melissa Radcliffe and Samba Bolde, to talk about the problems of their deportation. Some lawmakers are working to get support for the American Children's Act, a federal bill introduced to Congress in 2021. Deep Portell, an organizer of the effort to change the immigration law, explained,
"The legislation has two key principles. It puts in place a mechanism that allows children like us who have been raised and educated here to apply for permanent residence if we've been here for at least 10 years and if we graduate from an American university. And second, it fixes the loophole that causes children to age out in the first place."
Pranya Vella is a 17-year-old junior in Sun Prairie West High School. She also is a documented dreamer. Like thousands of others in Wisconsin and 250,000 in the U.S., Pranya was brought to the U.S. under her parents' H-1B visa. This is a visa given to foreign nationals to fill jobs for which there are no available Americans.
"My family and I illegally immigrated to the USA from India when I was 2 years old. It was here that I learned how to ride a bike, build my first snowman, and regularly attended my city's annual corn festival. This is the only country that I know of as home."
For Pranya's family, as well as many others, the law has an especially painful effect. Although she would be deported at age 21, her younger sister, born in the U.S., can stay, as well as her parents.
"Not only is she going to get to stay here, but I won't, despite the fact that this is my home as much as it is hers. But sometimes it's just hard to explain to her like all the difficulties that I'm going through. We both lived here for the same amount of time in our lives. I'm American as much as she is, mm-hmm. despite the fact that I was born in a different country."
Sai Kamanduri is a Madison alum. He's lived in Wisconsin since he was 5, did well as a pre-med major. He was accepted as a chemistry tutor, but then rejected because, as a non-citizen, he cannot be employed. Before applying for medical school, he learned that although he attended American schools, he would be considered as a foreign student, which would make the odds of acceptance much more difficult. He described the sense of uncertainty as he approaches the possibility of deportation.
"It's like I'm in a car alone on a one-way road, and I'm driving into a dark tunnel. I don't know what's on the other side of this tunnel, whether there's a dead end or not, but as I get closer and closer to the entrance of this tunnel, instead of there being any warning signs or anyone alerting me of the full picture or of what I'm about to face, all I notice are a bunch of speed bumps that get more and more aggressive as I get closer and closer. Like thousands of other immigrants or children of long-term visa holders in this country, I'm driving towards a future that I don't even know exists."
In the next legislative session, the legislators, Representatives Radcliffe and Bolde, will work on a resolution encouraging our congressional delegation to support the American Children's Act. At the end of the press conference, Representative Bolde, with whom I had previously worked, summed up the problem here as well as the current immigration law.
"We are all Americans. Whoever lives in this country is an American, whether you are born here or you choose to adopt this country. Particularly kids who has nowhere else to go, don't know any other person or other place but the United States. So today, we call on our congressional representative to do what is right."
Reporting for WORT, this is David Ahrens.
The time is now 6:32, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure, here with my co-host, Vicki Iden. Thanks for staying with us.
Extending empathy, preserving mental health, meeting students where they are at, and compensation that matches expectations. These are all topics up for discussion this week on Madison's Backbone. Irene and feature contributor Riley Cutright dig deeper into life as a middle school teacher.
This week, we're jumping right back in with Irene, who is a middle school world history teacher.
Middle schoolers are so ridiculous. I love them for that.
Yeah, I think it takes a special brand of person to want to teach middle school.
I agree with that fiercely, and I think like special brand is a generous way to say it. I think it takes a really weird human to want to do it. Like, if you would ask my students words they would use to describe me, they would say weird, and then they would say, for her, that's a compliment. It's fine.
Do you think that you and your colleagues receive enough recognition?
No. That was a very easy one to say quickly. I every day wish teachers got more recognition. And it's so funny because I think, generally speaking, too, teachers are the group that like don't necessarily want the spotlight in that way, or like don't do it for the recognition or the gratitude, but simultaneously feel like, I think so many teachers, including myself, would say like we went into this job like with great, like there are a lot of deep values and convictions behind it. Like we have the good fortune to have jobs that not only help us pay our bills, but are deeply rooted in our values and like being able to give back. That's a privilege. And to see culturally that there are so many expectations placed upon us and yet so little offered back to support us is incredibly frustrating. And like, honestly, a big part of that is financial compensation and recognition too. I'm really a loud and persistent voice within my own school community or in ways I can be for other teachers is just us being treated like the professionals we are and like to be compensated financially for that too. There's so much expected of teachers to volunteer their time or that this is service, and it isn't. It's a job. And that's real. And there should be no shame in saying that or asserting that, right? Like, there's so few teachers who I could think of who don't work outside of their contract hours, right? That's problematic because I know people do that because they feel like that's what they need to be able to put into it to do the job of teaching, to feel ethical in what they could put forth or offer to students. But there are systems that, like, right, there's leaderships, there's districts that see that and know that, and I think don't often enough use their voice to advocate on behalf of that. And again, I say this out of someone who I have the great fortune of being in an incredibly well-resourced district with incredibly supportive leadership. And right, these are still issues, right, of teachers working so much unpaid with responsibilities kind of piling on, but like recognition or support kind of not meeting that need. And that's hard.
Especially because, like, we would not be able to have a society without teachers. So,
and you, right, there should be an incentive from a hiring perspective and keeping teachers too. You want people who have strong convictions and values in this and who are able to bring so much of themselves in it. You want teachers who can access opportunities for learning to keep, like, growing in their content knowledge, growing in how to support students. Like, these are things we want, but all those things take time and money and emotional labor, and that needs to be at the very least recognize, and I would say at the very most, like, compensate it.
How does your job impact your daily life?
I feel like my job is the majority of my daily life, right? It's like a significant part of my time. I'm someone who can't like turn off my like teacher brain like ever. I think I am constantly seeing things through the lens of learning. So I think it impacts my life that way. Like, it's not right. Like, I'm a teacher and like 3:45 comes and then it's like, oh, let me take care of all the other things. Thinking about the successes or the challenges of the lessons, like continually like play through my head, you know, how I served my students well, how I hope to serve them better. Like, it's constantly going for me in ways that sometimes feel helpful and sometimes feel overwhelming too. No, yeah, but I circle back to like that, like, I am a teacher always. It is my job and it is my outlook on life. And I appreciate that. I'm also constantly tired because my brain is always going. And that is something maybe I like a little bit less. And I'm working to be like, how can I still be protective of my health while always holding on to that identity as teacher? because I would hope, I hope my students see this and feel this. So my teaching is student-centered, and it's through them. Like, whenever I'm creating or putting something together, like, it's not in a vacuum. I always have them in mind. And right, sometimes even very specific students in mind as I'm like constructing a discussion question or like deciding between like this source or that source. And I think it's also helped me. I think it has increased my like ability to extend empathy and to really go through life with this idea of like seeking to understand as opposed to like assuming my understanding on it. Because I think that's what you have to do as teachers to like make our learning community sound, right? Like sometimes I'm going to be having a great day and a student's going to be having an awful day. Like that might clash in a big way. And how could I stay anchored in the like seeking to understand where you're at and meeting you where you're at, but also like how can I still bring you into the space given that? I think that impacts my daily life. Like that doesn't just happen in my classroom, even though that's, I think I've noticed or been intentional about that more in my classroom. That definitely plays into my everyday life.
How much do you think that your work impacts Madison as a whole?
I really, really do believe teaching is a community practice. And I love that I've had students again, I've had siblings and families. And I think how we, like, particularly in a social studies class, right, a social studies class where the issues or what we're focusing on is, if it's not immediately current, it is current-ish, that they are grappling with questions and ideas that are immediately relevant to their lives. And I know those conversations aren't stopping in the classroom. I hope, too, how it impacts, like, the Madison community is, like, that, I, like, for me as a teacher, it is, like, my deepest value in it that I am supporting students in who they are becoming, right? And I am, like, one stop along the way in that journey for them. And I hope whatever they take out of learning social studies in particular, or like what our community looked like, or the ways of thinking that they got to explore in our classroom, like it is my hope that they're going to take that into the community wherever they go, and that they see that that matters in the community wherever they go. So I don't know if I know the full answer to how it impacts it, but I want to, and I have to believe that it does, or that it could, because if not, like, why are we doing this public school thing anyway? And we could just give kids, right, like a pile of stuff to read by themselves and like, okay, go learn things. But it's about like the ideas we explore and the community we foster. And I can't accept that that's just going to sit in them, that it's not, that they're not going to be giving back or doing things differently or seeing things differently because of how and what and the ways in which we learned in school.
Do you have any tips on getting hired?
The biggest advice I could tell about getting hired, well, first it would be like, just make sure you know the beautiful and wonderful, messy world you're about to enter into. Like, it is hard. And just be really aware of are you ready to try to navigate that hard? Because I think people go into teaching with like a love of content and a love of kids, which is so wonderful. And I think I would say tips to get hired is like anchor all of your answers, all the way you articulate your teaching, like in that, because a lot of noise is going to come at you, even in the process of applying to be a teacher. So just stay true to who you are. Like, don't think you have to be a particular kind of teacher or use particular kind of jargon in your answers, like, to get a job. Like, principals and leadership most authentically respond, like, when you are most authentically you. Like, if you are 22 years old coming right out of grad school, like, right out of undergrad, don't try and pretend to be a veteran teacher who's been doing it for years. Like, if they want someone right out of school, which they should, because that there's so much opportunity to grow and build that community connection, like, honor that, like, where you're at. If you are getting a sense from a school or a district that, like, the values don't match, read that too. Like, yes, applying for a job is about a job, and the financial aspect is very, very important to take into consideration. How you could think about longevity is if there are, right, if you feel like you will be valued and your values are represented in that space.
If you can give one tip or trick to someone who just got hired, what would it be?
Find your teacher bestie. It's my very official teacher term for that. Yeah, find that one person who can offer you comfort on the days that feel challenging, whose room you could walk into and you could be fully who you are, whether that's someone who's like crying and overwhelmed or someone who's just like bursting with joy about how something went. Like, find that person who you could share all those things with and build that trust with, because at least for me, like, I could not do this job of teaching in isolation. It is like, when I say community practice, I mean like community with my students, community with like the town my school is situated in, but also like community with my colleagues. And I know my 4 years of teaching have been wonderful, even through a global pandemic, even through incredible struggles at our district or in our grade level, because I've had two other people really beside me being my biggest support there. So my tip would be find that person, because you it will offer you and your students so much to be able to have that support.
That's awesome. I'm Riley, and I'm here with Irene, and we hope that you enjoyed listening to Madison's Backbone today. And if nobody has thanked you today,
thank you.
And it's time now for the most comprehensive weather report on the airwaves with WORT weather guru, Rob McClure.
Well, the storm still rattling your window panes outside was not a complete surprise to us, but as I mentioned on the Monday morning forecast, there were a number of variables to its evolution, which remained fluid even into Monday afternoon. So few forecasts before then managed to accurately assess certain important aspects of it, like its hourly precipitation rates yesterday or its snowfall totals. I have to admit, I was a bit stunned by just how heavy and continuous the rains were yesterday afternoon before turning over to snow, well, in the morning and the afternoon, I guess. We had just about a full inch of rain down by the time it turned over, and then we got another 4.1 inches of snow on top of that for a liquid total yesterday of 1.31 inches. That was a precipitation record for the day, though the snowfall total did fall slightly short of the 4.9 inches that occurred back in 1975. Have a look at the water vapor image of the contiguous U.S. that we have linked in the featured graphics on the WORT weather webpage this evening, and you'll get a nice visualization of how to put together a strong spring storm. This image has the surface pressure fields imprinted on it, which makes it especially useful for this purpose. As I mentioned Monday, the storm was built of two separate components, a low-pressure circulation approaching from the southwest that was already in the process of being evacuated and deepened by a strong upper jet above it, and then a lobe of quite cold air and its associated upper trough, which were at the same time swinging down this way from the northwest. You can see those separate elements quite distinctly on the water vapor, coming together and swirling impressively over the Wisconsin-Illinois border yesterday afternoon, with a subsequent deepening and tightening together of those yellow isobars on the image. You can overlay the upper wind fields on that image with the buttons at the left, and if you do that, you can see upper winds spreading apart prodigiously over southern Wisconsin during that same time frame from late morning through the afternoon, creating the sustained lift that produced that heavy rain episode and the accumulating snow. Well, this storm is now occluding and weakening, but it is becoming vertically stacked at the same time, and the swirl in the vapor on the image you can see sitting now right over top of the surface low. So the system's egress to the east is going to be slow, and its backside northerly winds will continue to swing pulses of stronger energy and leftward turning overhead here for the next couple of days, creating passing paroxysms of lift and accompanying precipitation. But by later Friday into Saturday, incoming surface high pressure from Canada will begin to pass overhead, clearing skies and starting us to warm already by Saturday afternoon as its backside winds begin to veer southeasterly ahead of an approaching low pressure system, which will be swirling northeastward out of Colorado by that time. We have been watching the system closely since it has the potential to affect Monday's viewing of the eclipse across much of the eastern and central U.S., including here. As the model runs have continued to come in, it appears that this storm is likely to occlude well out to our west on Sunday and sweep a frontal boundary east and northeastward across the Midwest with accompanying showers and other precipitation Sunday into Sunday night. Those showers generally clear east of the Mississippi River into the Ohio Valley by the early part of Monday now on all of the major longer-range models. And both the global forecast systems and the Canadian models are currently indicating clearing under the prevailing upper-level winds, which will be directed across about northern Arkansas, southern Missouri, and southern Illinois. That appears to be true both on sky cover models and on soundings. So cross your fingers. I have added a link to the weather page this evening right at the up at the top where you can compare forecast model outcomes, so that may be of use, especially if you're traveling. I do think we'll be cloudy here with low pressure passing quite nearby us to the south early Monday. But back to the specifics of the forecast, tonight the skies will continue to be heavily overcast with the occasional flurry as well, and temperatures holding pretty much where they are now in the low to mid-30s, and continued strong northerly winds at 12 to 20 miles per hour, still with gusts up towards 30 miles per hour or better from time to time. More concerted snow showers will then begin working into the area from the north as we get on towards dawn tomorrow, and probably last for a few hours as a lobe of vorticity spins overhead. Temperatures tomorrow will rise into the upper 30s on northerly winds continuing at 12 to 20 miles per hour. The sky should lift and break more as we get into the afternoon, or at least later in the afternoon, and that process will continue through the overnight hours, with temperatures dropping back into the upper 20s on diminishing northerly winds, which will come down to 8 to 12 miles per hour. Friday, any clearing early in the day is, I think, likely to fill in with cumulus and perhaps stratocumulus for a good period of time as we get into the morning hours and perhaps into the early afternoon, with then more lifting and breaking as we get on through the afternoon into the evening. Temperatures will reach the low 40s on northerly winds at 8 to 12 miles per hour. Sky should clear more overnight. That'll allow the temperatures to drop into the mid-20s probably, given lighter, more northeasterly winds. And Saturday should be mostly sunny with temperatures in the upper 40s by afternoon and northeasterly winds veering east and southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour later in the day. Skies will cloud up again overnight as southeasterly winds continue to increase ahead of the storm out on the plains, and Sunday will be breezy and in the mid-40s, probably with a passing round of warm frontal showers, with what will by then be the dissipating low pressure system lifting into Iowa and heading this direction. At the moment, at the station down here on Bedford Street, the temperature is 35 degrees. The dew point temperature is 30. Low overcast up at about 1,500 feet. Winds are out of the north at 15 miles per hour, still gusting up towards 30 miles per hour with some regularity. And the barometer is at 29.45 inches of mercury and rising steadily and fairly quickly.
We go now to April 1968 for the aftermath of the assassination of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Stu Levitan has that news and more on this week's edition of Madison in the 60s.
They melt into a dream.
Madison in the 60s, April 1968, Friday, April 5th. Once again, thousands gather to grieve atop Bascom Hill, just as they did in 1963 for the state's official memorial for President Kennedy. But this time, the mourning is different. The morning after Dr. Martin Luther King's assassination in Memphis starts with a heated disagreement between Chancellor William Sewall and a group of about 20 black student leaders over their competing plans for service that noon at Lincoln Terrace. Sewall, who has already canceled that afternoon's classes, wants the students to speak as part of the official university program, an idea they emphatically shout down. A black person was killed by a white person, declares Sidney Glass, head of Concerned Black People, and black people must lead the memorial, not just speak as part of the program. Things get tense. Sewall yields. He agrees to make introductory remarks, announce that he's keeping several buildings open for students to gather in later, and then allow the black students to run the program. The program itself is full of bitterness and anger. Clara Meek, one of five students to speak during the 20-minute program, breaks into tears. "I have a dream, too," she says to the crowd of about 10,000, almost all white, "that one day every darn one of you is going to pay." Kenneth Irwin says, quote, "There is no other course for black people to take than to riot." And unlike during President Kennedy's memorial service, there's a march at an estimated 15,000, fully filling six blocks of State Street. It's the biggest demonstration in Madison's history to date, other than to celebrate an athletic championship or the end of a war. Rows of black Madisonians up front leak arms and alternate between freedom songs and militant chants. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, interspersed with black power. They march around the Capitol and up Wisconsin Avenue, heading down Langdon Street to the foot of Science Hall, where they sing two choruses of We Shall Overcome, then move in great numbers to the buildings that Sewell has kept open. Once there, they stay for hours, black and white, engaging in the most candid conversations about race the campus has ever seen. Observing the packed auditorium in social sciences, Sewell thinks it's the capstone to, quote, the greatest day for education that had ever hit the campus. The regents aren't so impressed. They pass a rule requiring permission of the president and the regents' executive committee to declare a campus holiday. Saturday night, the biggest folk singing group in the country is at the Dane County Coliseum. Peter, Paul, and Mary open their concert with a tribute to King and a haunting rendition of Bob Dylan's When the Ship Comes In. Sunday afternoon is dark and windy as a crowd of 3,000 gathers at the Capitol for the Communities program. It's highlighted by stinging comments from concerned black people's Ardenette Tucker, who condemns, quote, the Madison community which still believes there are no race problems here. I will break some windows to make you care. Then four white men, Reverend Alfred Swan, Professor Maurice Zeitlin, businessman Jack Van Meterheim, and Father Joseph Hammer, lead the silent march down State Street and out University Avenue to the First Congregational Church for a memorial service, attended by Governor Mrs. Warren Knowles, Mayor Otto Feske, and other dignitaries. Equal Opportunities Commission Chair Reverend James Wright speaks. Reverend Swan recites Lincoln's second inaugural address. Rabbi Manfred Swarzenski preaches scripture. And Reverend Robert Borgwart reads from King's letter from Birmingham Jail. Reverend Richard Pritchard, the only Madison cleric to have spent time in the South for civil rights, is not invited to participate. A special offering for Dr. King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference collects over $1,000. On Tuesday, Madison School Superintendent Douglas Ritchie keeps schools in session during King's funeral, but he tells principals that pupils, quote, must be well informed as to the significance of Dr. King's life and informed concerning the issues of equality for all students. Two nights later, the City Council finally agrees to the long-standing request from the Equal Opportunities Commission for a paid executive director and votes 19-2 to create and fund the $10,000 position. Mayor Otto Feske says it's, quote, a matter of the highest priority as the events of the past week have lent a special sense of urgency to the issue. The commission has been led for the past several years by its volunteer chair, Reverend Wright. The only alderman to speak in opposition is a member of the EOC, Alderman James Crary, employed by a Dane County deputy sheriff and appointed to the commission by former Mayor Henry Reynolds. I don't think we have a serious racial problem in Madison, Crary says, but within 5 years, with a director, we will have one. When Crary's term on the commission expires 2 weeks later, Mayor Feske does not reappoint him. As expected, Feske on May 18th names as the EOC's first executive director, its chair, Reverend Wright. A native South Carolinian, the 42-year-old Wright holds a bachelor's degree in psychology from the University of Wisconsin, formerly served as associate pastor at Mount Zion Baptist Church, and operated a nearby barbershop. This spring, he has also been attending the Urban Training Center at the University of Chicago, focusing on police-community relations. And April 68 is a cruel month for the university itself, as Regents President Kenneth L. Greenquist, an eloquent and forceful advocate for the university during difficult days, dies of cancer at age 58, the day after King's murder, not quite 6 years into his 9-year term. A former 2-term state senator from the Progressive Party, a Navy lieutenant with World War II combat experience in both the Atlantic and Pacific theaters, and past commander of the American Legion, the Racine attorney was ideally suited to defend the university against conservative attacks. He fought the American Legion itself in the mid-1950s when it denounced the university for allowing left-wing speakers and pushed back against more recent Republican criticism of the Daily Cardinal and student protesters. His death, and the end that month of fellow Liberal Arthur DeBartle Baden's 9-year term leaves only 2 Democrats on the board, enabling the 7 appointees of Republican Governor Warren Knowles to effect what DeBartle Baden calls, quote, a partisan takeover of the leadership that will, quote, harm the university. And that's this week's Madison in the 60s. For your award-winning, listener-sponsored WORT News Team, I'm Stu Levitan.
And that does it for our show this evening. Thanks for listening to WORT's live local news at 6. Our headline writer this evening was Greg Sanderson. Our reporter was David Ahrens. Special thanks to our feature contributors Riley Cutright and Stu Levitan. Katie Gergella flawlessly engineered tonight's show on our brand new soundboards. Thank you, Katie. Bay Parks produced the newscast, and Shelley Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure.
And I'm your host, Vicki Iden. Stay up to date with the WORT local news podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is Query, followed by This Way Out. Good night.